time for Israel is Real. Two Israelis putting a human face on all things Israel. Rahel and Sonia focus on life in modern 21st century Israel, telling the stories of ordinary people living in, loving, and in support of an extraordinary land. Israel is Real is a community-supported program featuring interviews with local, national, and international celebrities, personal life stories, and call-ins. Learn a new Hebrew word every week. Israel is Real. Every Friday on 1590 WSMN, Nashua's News and Talk. And now, your hosts, Rahel and Sonia.
Hi, we're Rachel
and Sonia,
and this is Israel, Israel, the free voice for Israel. Boker tov lekol ha'mazinim.
Tovim b'Israel.
From WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk. You can also hear us, if you're not local, on WSMNradio.com. So please tune into the internet if you're not a local listener. And locally, we have about 100,000 nice listeners. How are you doing out there? I hope you're enjoying our shows.
Yes, they are. Everyone on each of them.
Everyone. Everyone is a gem. What's our Hebrew word for today?
Hartza'a.
Hartza'a.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about hartza'a.
Hartza'a means shortly a lecture.
A lecture?
Yeah.
Okay. Simply put, a lecture.
That's it.
And we're telling you this because we do want to announce a very, very important lecture coming up that we hope you will all attend. You're invited to participate in an evening of showing honor to the State of Israel and to the Jewish people at the Massachusetts Night to Honor Israel, which is going to take place this Sunday, May 15th at 6:30 p.m. at the Faith Christian Church, which is on 40 Boutelle Street in Fitchburg, Massachusetts. The guest speaker is our guest today, and we are going to tell you a little bit about her, Sandra Osterbaras. And this is, by the way, a pre-recorded interview. This is part two. We did hear part one last week, so if you didn't get a chance to hear it, go to our website at israelisrealnh.com, and we'll tell you more about that. So Sandra Osterbaras grew up in a Jewish Orthodox home in America. She completed her BA in History and English at Barnard College in New York and obtained her JD at Columbia University School of Law in 1984. After practicing law in New York for a short time, Sandra moved to Israel, where she continued her legal career after being accepted to the Israeli bar. Today, she lives in Karnei Shomron, which is in Israel, and is an active spokesperson for the communities of Judea, Samaria, and Gaza. She's the director of the Israel Office of CFOIC, Christian Friends of Israeli Communities, which is the only Christian organization to focus exclusively on the communities in the heartland of biblical Israel. Sandra coordinates much of CFOIC's Heartland's community support programs worldwide. They have, in addition to the United States and Israel offices, they have offices in Germany and Holland, and there are more growing every day. So today, and again, I repeat, Sunday, May 15th, the Hartza'a, the lecture with Sandra Osterbaras will take place at 6:30 p.m. at the Faith Christian Church, so be there. We're going to hear now the pre-recorded interview part two of Sandra Osterbaras about Gaza today. Israel is Real. Sandra Osterbaras, it's so nice to have you. We know that you're coming very soon on a speaking tour. You want to tell us when that's happening?
Well, I'll be arriving in Massachusetts on the 15th of May.
Welcome. And where will you be speaking, if you want to just tell our listeners that right off, and then we'll get into a little bit more about you, and we'll repeat that at the end too, so people can come and see you.
Okay, well, I will be speaking Sunday night the 15th in Fitchburg, Massachusetts. There's a Night to Honor Israel that will take place there at Faith Christian Church, so that's my first event. And there will be a small pastors group the next day on the Monday the 16th, and after that I leave Massachusetts and go on to Arkansas.
Arkansas?
Yeah, Arkansas, then Texas, then Ohio, yeah.
Wow.
Colorado, oh, I forgot about Colorado. That's in there too somewhere.
Oh, I wish we could get you into New Hampshire. It's sometimes, you know, New Hampshire is a very rural place, and it's sometimes difficult to get people. But
I was actually in New Hampshire about a year ago. I had a few very small meetings, but, you know, if there's an audience there who is interested, that I could certainly schedule that next time I'm coming out to that area.
Right. And we'll certainly send them to Fitchburg this time around, which is not too far.
Right. That would be great.
So, Sandra Astabaras, tell our listeners again just a little bit background about you, because we did speak about it the last week, and about the organization, Christian Friends of Israeli Communities.
That's right. Well, I am personally not Christian. I'm an Orthodox Jew, and I live in Karnei Shomron, which is a town in Samaria. And I've been involved with this organization, Christian Friends of Israeli Communities, since it was founded in 1995, and have been running the Israel office since 1998. And it's really grown over the years, and we are essentially the only Christian organization whose exclusive focus is on the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria. We also were involved in connecting with the Jewish communities in Gaza until they were destroyed, and we continue to work with those people who were thrown from their homes 5 years ago. So basically, I'm the Jewish part of this organization. The Christian side is all over the world. We have a U.S. office run by Christians in Colorado, and it's a real partnership between Christians and Jews to support the people living in the heart of biblical Israel in Judea and Samaria.
And we will encourage our listeners to listen to our archived interview with you last week. But just briefly, those who missed it, tell us about the heartland. What is that geographically speaking?
Well, we're in the area that's often referred to as the West Bank. This is the center of Israel. It takes up about more than three-quarters of the width of Israel in the center of the country. People talk about the pre-67 borders that are only 9 miles wide at the narrowest point near Netanya. Well, we're the rest. Before 67, this area was occupied by Jordan, and now, of course, it is part of Israel, although it is quite in dispute, and people all over the world are calling for Israel to withdraw from this area. Withdrawing would mean the forced removal of 320,000 Jews who have made their homes in this area during the last 40 years.
We're going to move, essentially, from what we spoke of last week into really getting down to the strategic value and importance of the region of Judea and Samaria as Israel's heartland, and strategically speaking, and in relation to Gaza, as our listeners might know as Gaza.
Uh-huh.
And let's start maybe with Gaza or Gaza. To whom does Gaza belong?
Well, a lot have happened recently, you know, in the last 5 years in Gaza. The issue of the Gaza Strip, this was just another part of Mandatory Palestine. When Israel became a state, the war was fought. Egypt came up from the south and captured Gaza and held onto it. Of course, they tried to get all the way to Tel Aviv. They didn't manage, and they ended up controlling Gaza from 1948 to 1967. In 1967, they, like Jordan, attacked Israel from Gaza, and during that war, Israel then repelled the attack and conquered Gaza together with the Sinai. Now, later on, when Israel entered into a peace agreement with Egypt, Egypt insisted on taking back or receiving back all of the Sinai, had absolutely no interest in having Gaza. So Israel retained control over Gaza. Now, from a historical and a biblical point of view, of course, Gaza is part of the land of Israel, and it always has been. In fact, there are ruins of an ancient synagogue in the city of Gaza itself that goes back hundreds of years, and we know that there was a vibrant Jewish community, even though small, in Gaza until 1929. the same riots that destroyed and massacred Jews in Hebron in 1929 also massacred Jews in Gaza and in Shechem. I don't, a lot of people don't realize that, but there were Jewish communities in those places as well. In any case,
and they were very terrible massacres.
Terrible. Yeah. These were Arab riots that were of course, led by the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who was, shall we say, the forebear of the Palestinian terrorists that we recognize today.
And
anyway,
if I may, I don't know if I'm correct in saying, you can correct me, but also might have been a proxy of Britain, which had control over the land at the time.
No, not the Grand Mufti. The Mufti was actually allied with Germany, and Britain expelled the Mufti at the beginning of World War, actually before World War II. And that was in 1929. He was leading all these riots. Afterwards, he was expelled and found him and ended up going to Berlin, allying himself with Hitler and broadcasting against not only Jews but against the British. So he certainly wasn't part of that. But there's no question that later on, the British, as their time in Israel came to an end, they did side more and more with the Arab side than they did with the Jews. There's no question.
Thank you for that clarification.
Sorry.
Okay. Yes, and sorry to interrupt you. So back to Gaza.
So back to Gaza. So basically what happened then, about 6 years ago, a little bit more than that, Ariel Sharon, who was then the prime minister, pushed forward this decision to unilaterally withdraw from the Gaza Strip. At the time, there were about 9,000 Jews living in about 17 Jewish communities in the Gaza Strip. These communities were located in areas of the Gaza Strip that had been empty of anyone living there. They didn't go into the middle of, an Arab community, but they actually developed most of the communities on the sand dunes, places where nobody could believe anything could grow, and they not only built beautiful communities, but developed amazing agriculture. In fact, they were responsible for 60% of the exports of organic produce from Israel. Unfortunately, however, Ariel Sharon gave up, and he just felt like, well, if we can just, move out of Gaza, we can demonstrate to the world that we are indeed willing to make compromises. And there are people who believe, I'm not sure how to interpret Ariel Sharon, but there are people who believe that what he was trying to do with this was to save Judea and Samaria. I'm not sure that's true. But in any case, this is what happened. The assumption being, let's test the waters. Let's see what happens when Israel withdraws. So first of all, it caused unbelievable harm to the people themselves. 9,000 people were uprooted, forced from their homes. Most of these people, about 80 to 85% of these people, actually worked in the Gaza Strip itself. So not only did they lose their homes and their communities, but they lost their jobs. And it was a terrible, heart-wrenching experience that we haven't finished, because even today, 5.5 years later, only about 15% of those removed from their homes are now living in permanent homes. Most are still living in these temporary residential areas, not that different from what you would think of as a refugee camp. And indeed, that's what these people are. But on top of all that, as I said, this was a testing. Okay, what are the Arabs going to do? We have them, Gaza. The truth of the matter is, they could have said, okay, we're going to show the world that we really are interested in peace. They could have turned the Gaza Strip into a Singapore. There were donor nations from all over the world that were just waiting for the opportunity to pour millions of dollars into the Gaza Strip and turn the place into a paradise. But what happened instead was that the Palestinians voted in the Hamas. The Hamas then launched a bloody revolt and took over full control of the Gaza Strip and have been launching rockets and missiles against Israel ever since. So the so-called test proved to us beyond a shadow of a doubt that Israel moving out of these areas is a really bad idea.
And you spoke about the agriculture, the beautiful and wonderful agriculture that the Jewish communities done in Gaza. In Gaza, they do not have any agriculture in the same territories that the Jewish community had?
Well, right after Israel withdrew from the Gaza Strip, It was amazing. I remember watching this on television the very night that closed the gates on Gaza. Mm-hmm. Arabs went into the greenhouses, and this is what happened. The farmers actually just left growing concern. And in fact, there was so much faith in these people. They had such faith that it wouldn't happen that they even planted in the spring. So they did not only leave greenhouses intact, but they left greenhouses with plants that were ready to be harvested in the coming months. And the Arabs went in and just tore down these greenhouses. They wanted the scrap metal, they wanted the rubber, to sell on the black market. They were handed an opportunity to walk in and take over farms, and they destroyed it. It was the most amazing thing. And then, of course, all the homes had been destroyed by Israel because we just couldn't face the idea of our terrorist enemies walking into these beautiful homes and just helping themselves to them. So those were destroyed by Israel. But the synagogues and the public buildings were all left standing.
And the synagogues,
of course, all the holy books and everything was taken out of the synagogues, but the buildings themselves were left standing. And these Arabs came in and burnt them all down.
And what about the famine that the population in Gaza suffering so much?
The famine?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, famine. It's a lie.
Okay.
First of all, I've seen pictures that have been sent around, and I'm sure you can get these on the YouTube or the Internet or whatever, of the markets. You know, there's plenty of food in Gaza. First of all, Israel has allowed food to go in. They've never prevented food from going in. The only thing Israel is saying is that nothing can go into Gaza without being checked first. Because, of course, in addition to food, the Arabs might want to bring in, and they do want to bring in, arms and all kinds of things that endanger Israel's security. Now, there is, in addition to the food and shipments that are going in legally through Israel, there is an enormous illegal transport going in tunnels that have been dug between Egypt, between the Sinai, actually, and Gaza. Some of these tunnels are so large that trucks can drive through them, and they do.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how the missiles come in, and the rockets, and the terrorists, and Al-Qaeda people, and, of course, luxury items as well. So there's a booming black market in Gaza, and it seems for a price you can get absolutely anything.
Well, not to mention that there are not just food and supplies going into Gaza. I would say that a lot of money from around the world is also going into Gaza.
Absolutely. And we know, first of all, Israel has a great deal of intelligence that reports on this, but Israel has managed to stop some of this, but only a small amount. And just from these small number of these sorts of shipments that Israel stops, we know what else they're trying to bring in. Just recently, Israel stopped a ship that was on its way from Europe. It stopped in Syria, where the ship, I think, was flying under some country flag, and it seems that the captain of the ship didn't even know what was in its hold. They picked up suspicious cargo in Syria, and then were making its way to Egypt, where this shipment was going to go overland into Gaza. And it turns out, when the Israeli army boarded the ship, they discovered in shipping containers that were labeled as carrying grain, they found weapons, high-grade weapons. And this was confiscated, of course. So this is going on. So Israel manages to stop some things, but we certainly aren't stopping at all.
Well, it seems there's a tremendous money-making industry going on there, so I would imagine that the interest in stopping that is not very big.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I want to ask you, now, when Egypt, going back to 1979, when Egypt signed the peace agreement with Israel, and I'm curious as to why Sadat included the Sinai, which, oh, what a beautiful place it is or was at the time. I remember visiting there very often. But why did Egypt include the Sinai but refuse Gaza?
Well, again, we saw some similar thing happening with Jordan, declaring that no longer having any interest in Judea and Samaria. The Palestinian Arabs are a pain in the neck, and they are a very serious destabilizing force in the Middle East. terrorism is rampant in that society, and no government that has any interest in its own stability is interested in having the Palestinians in their midst, which, of course, is very ironic because they are very eager to have us solve this problem and be stuck with them, but they don't want to have them themselves.
It's
is called politics.
It's very difficult for people to sort of grasp these ideas that you're speaking about, and I'm so glad that you are able to voice them and clarify for our listeners really what's going on. And we're so glad, Sandra Osterbaros, to have you on our show. I'm also a little bit saddened, you know, that the Sinai is becoming so corrupt now, because I remember it as such a beautiful place. The Bedouin at the time were flourishing with wonderful businesses and Israelis that were catering to Israelis, and they were doing quite well. Uh-huh. I had a wonderful Bedouin friend, and I understand that even Sinai has become under the corrupt kind of stuff that's going on there today. You know, when you talk about tunnels, what is this about tunnels? And, you know, what is it with the Arabs and tunnels?
Well, first of all, Sinai, I think, is a brilliant example of what the entire Middle East can become. Sinai is a no man's land. Sinai is a place that almost no one controls. It is Egyptian territory. And I would assume if Egypt wanted to control Sinai better, they would. Well, maybe not today, but let's say a year ago. But it was always this kind of place where, on the one hand, Israelis continue to go there. Even though there's ongoing warnings against Israelis going there because of the danger of terrorism, it's so attractive, and there are still many places where the Bedouin are incredibly hospitable and friendly and are eager for the Israelis to come, and they can have a wonderful vacation experience. But at the same time, we have other Bedouin and other people there who are working with Al-Qaeda. We have Bedouin who are smuggling refugees from South Sudan and from Eritrea across the Sinai into Israel,
and
smuggling them
into
Israel, and sometimes torturing these people at the same time. We have Bedouin that are cooperating with the Hamas and are digging tunnels from Sinai, from the northern part of Sinai, across into Gaza and taking part in what is an amazingly lucrative smuggling business. So there's all kinds of people in Sinai, and it is such a free-for-all that it's insane. And if you ask me, this is what the Middle East is going to look like if the kind of riots we see happening to now are happening. There's no question in my mind there are good people in the Middle East. There are good people in the Arab world. But in the absence of any kind of moral control, of any kind of stable government, it's a free-for-all. And you're going to have terrorists doing what they want.
It's so sad. I mean, I've driven in taxis with Arab taxi drivers who have constantly, you know, we've had these conversations and about peace, and, you know, wouldn't the Middle East be a fantastic, amazing region if we could only achieve some kind of, you know, get rid of this corruption? Because in my mind, you know, it's an absolute oasis, an absolute utopia that could be there. And everybody could benefit from, but it somehow can't seem to get there.
This is WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk, and you're listening to Israel is Real, the free voice for Israel. And we are also hearing the music of Bruce Berger, Rebbe Soul, from his album From Another World. www.rebbesoul.com, Rebbesoule. And wouldn't it be awesome if 100,000 people, hey, maybe millions, would know about your business, your product, or your service? Wouldn't it be even more amazing if your business were helping to stop hatred and terrorism by supporting the good news about Israel? You can do this by sponsoring a Hebrew word, the Torah portion, or even a weekly Israel is Real show. So take out your checkbook now and make a donation, advertise, sponsor a show, or even have us read a greeting or on a special occasion. By supporting Israel is Real, you make the world a better place. So write a check now to Absolute Broadcasting, send it to our personal mailbox, at Israel Israel, P.O. Box 236, Milford, New Hampshire, 03055. Again, write it to Absolute Broadcasting. Send it to our personal mailbox at Israel Israel, P.O. Box 236, Milford, New Hampshire, 03055. You can also find more information at www.israelisraelnh.com, ISRAELISRAELNH.com.
Did you know that Vision is an organization that educates our community about the little country of Israel? Did you know Israel is approximately about the size of New Jersey? And did you know about religious majorities in countries around the world? For example, we have 56 Islamic countries, 49 Roman Catholic countries, 20 Protestant countries, 12 Eastern Orthodox countries, 4 Hindus, and 1 Jewish state. In order to have more information, please go to our Vision website at www.newhampshireforisrael.org. That's www.nh4israel.org.
The patent and trademark law firm of Vern Main & Associates, a local firm with a global practice, is pleased to announce its new office location at 547 Amherst Street in Nashua and on the web at www.vernmain.com. For professional legal counseling on all intellectual property matters, contact the legal specialist at Vern Main & Associates at their offices on 547 Amherst Street in Nashua, New Hampshire, or on the web at vernmaine.com, www.vernmaine.com, vernmaine.com.
Have you heard the buzz? Rachel's music is touching hearts of listeners all around the world. To hear Rachel's unique sound and to book Rachel to perform for you live, go to www.rachelmusic.net. That's www.rahelmusic.net.
Dr. James Haas of Vanguard Dental Group in Derry, New Hampshire, is a board-certified pediatric dentist who is extremely talented at putting anxious children at ease so they have a positive dental experience. Dr. Jim Haas specializes in treating children with special emotional or physical needs by way of sedation and operating room dentistry. Dr. Jim Haas is currently accepting new patients. Your child will enjoy dental visits with Dr. Jim Haas. Call 603-434-1586 or visit www.vanguarddentalgroup.com to learn more about Dr. Jim Haas. You're listening to WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk. You're hearing Israel is Real, the free voice for Israel. We will continue right now our interview with Sandra Osterbaras, who is speaking about Gaza, Judea, and Samaria. Sandra will be in Massachusetts for A Night to Honor Israel, Sunday, May 15th at 6:30 p.m. at the Faith Christian Church, 40 Boutelle Street, Fitchburg, Mass. You can call 978-342-8522 or email jewishheart@cfaith.com. Sandra Osterbaras.
We're so glad, Sandra Osterbaras, to have you on our show. Let's talk again about Judea and Samaria and the connection, or how is it either connected to or in relation to Gaza? What is the relationship here? What are we looking at?
Okay, well, geographically, there's no connection. Gaza is on the western edge of Israel on the Mediterranean. It's a sandy kind of place, dry, and Judea and Samaria is in the center of the country. It's a mountain area. What connects them is the fact that both of these areas were lost to Israel in the 1948 war. Israel emerged a state without those places. Gaza was occupied by Egypt, and Judea and Samaria were occupied by Jordan. Both of these places were the location of attacks against Israel in 1967, and both of those places were then captured by Israel in the Six-Day War. the settlement movement that grew up after the 67 war that recognized this victory as an amazing opportunity and indeed a responsibility of the Jewish people to go and reclaim our heritage in these places in the same way that we reclaimed our heritage in the Galilee and the Negev and in Jerusalem a generation earlier. That is what links these two, because the settlement movement essentially set its sights on both of those places as parts of the land of Israel that were now available for Jewish settlement. And so if we talk about the settlement movement, if we talk about the ideology that is behind the settling of these areas, it was one movement. Unfortunately, Gaza is no longer part of the settlement movement. This area was forced from us. We hope that one day the circumstances will allow us to go back and rebuild those communities and many more. And we do believe that will happen. It may take a few years. It may take a few generations. But it will ultimately happen. But it is the same ideology that fueled both settlement areas.
Is the profile of the Arab population in Gaza Strip and in the so-called West Bank, uh-huh, is the same profile?
Of the Arabs?
Yes.
Within Arab society, they're viewed differently. There's a certain class structure. Arabs from certain parts of, for example, an Arab from Shechem or Nablus will look upon an Arab from Hebron differently. You know, there will be a snob factor involved there. Mm-hmm. The Arabs in Judea and Samaria look upon the Arabs as Gaza, as a lower class. That's just kind of built into the Arab society already for you know, generations.
Could this be regarded as sort of a tribal kind of atmosphere?
Yeah, it's coming from something that has absolutely nothing to do with Israel, mm-hmm, or nothing to do with the political reality. But today, I would say there's also a certain political issue where we have, on the one hand, the Palestinian Authority or the Fatah, and we have a rival group, the Hamas, of course, being much more radical, much more fundamentalist, and so those groups exist in both places, and you have the same kind of conflict within each place where you'll have Hamas in Gaza identifying with Hamas in Judea and Samaria, and same with the Fatah. Hmm. And of course there's family relations, and the family relations, by the way, cross over into Jordan the same way.
And they are going also to Lebanon or Syria.
Oh, sure.
And actually, in Gaza Strip, from my understanding, you have an more Egyptian population that are living there than you have different population in West Bank. They can come from Lebanon, from Syria, from even from Iraq, and so on, and of course from Jordan.
There's different populations. There are populations that were in Gaza. Most of the Arabs that live in Israel today either came down from Syria, or they came up from Egypt or Arabia.
Right.
And in more recent times, you also have the refugees, the Palestinians who lived in what is today the state of Israel and who ran in 1948, the ones from the south, let's say from Ashkelon.
Right.
Ashkelon was once an Arab town. The people who left Ashkelon went to the Gaza Strip because it's right there. Whereas the people who lived in Tel Aviv, or in it would be in Jaffa actually, or people who lived in the Galilee, they would have gone into Samaria because it was closer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting.
It's not as simple.
It's not a homogenic population. Right. This is the question. This is the.
Well, you know, the irony, of course, is you have all these people talking about a Palestinian people. And, you know, I remember Golda Meir saying there's no such thing as a Palestinian people.
Right.
And it's true. It's an invented identity. Because if you're going to try to find some on the one hand, you have tribal identity and family identity, and that's certainly smaller than a national identity. But if you're trying to go above that and find a common denominator for a national identity, it will encompass Jordan, at the very least, the same way it encompasses the Arabs living in Israel and Judea and Samaria and Gaza. They're the same. And it would probably encompass most of the people in Lebanon and Syria. Although I read something very interesting recently when an analysis of Syria, there's an Israeli expert on Syria who has recently said that Syria itself is an unnatural state, mm-hmm. and that actually it's made up of a few distinct ethnic groups, and that if Syria now, if Assad falls, he anticipates Syria dividing into something like four different states.
And only to emphasize the point about what's the meaning of being a Palestinian, my father-in-law was born in Eretz Israel in 1927. Uh-huh. And he have a born certificate that we are so happy to have it. And it's clear there that he is a Palestinian born.
Uh-huh.
So... only to emphasize how right. the name migrate from one side to the other side.
Right, absolutely. No, it's true. And indeed, I believe before the State of Israel was created, the Arabs themselves, even though the Arabs who were born in Palestine, they never referred to themselves as Palestinians. They would refer to themselves as Arabs. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Jews who lived in Palestine would mm-hmm. call themselves Palestinians.
Right, exactly
in,
right.
In fact, many... I've spoken to a few Arabs who, Israeli Arabs today, who would identify themselves as Jordanians, in fact,
uh-huh.
And hold Jordanian citizenship, in fact. And speaking of citizenship, I have a few questions, you know, since we've been talking. I think I'm going to go to this idea of Judenrein. You know, it boggles the mind why in Israel... or anywhere in the world, why people think that Jews have no right to live anywhere and need to be these particular areas need to be rid of Jews. Why is this? Why can't Jews live in these areas? Why can't the Arabs say you can live here? And if Jews
exactly like the Arabs are living with us,
right?
All over the place. I mean, in Israel,
anybody can live in Israel. And after, you know, a certain amount of time, like I would think in most countries, when you've resided there for a certain amount of time and you go through a certain legal process, you become a citizen. Now, we look at the Arabs who ran away or who have become refugees for whatever reasons in their own Arab neighboring states have never been allowed to become citizens in 60-plus right. years. What the heck, you know? You'd think that after 60-some-odd years, these people would be allowed to become citizens and become contributing people of the land that they, of the country that they are now living in, and just, you know, as anywhere else in the world. But they are not allowed to, by their own people, not allowed. And now we have a phenomenon where Jews, wherever they go, they're being exiled from that, deported. They're not allowed to be part. In a way, we share a similar lavdil, you know, a similar fate where we're not allowed to live anywhere and acquire and become citizens. And if Jews choose to live in an Arab country and follow the laws there, why can't they? And why do we have to be uprooted from our homes and become homeless and become refugees in our own country? What the heck is going on here?
Well, I think that question needs to really be approached from two sides. First of all, you're absolutely right. From the Arab point of view, how is it that they get away with saying, when we have our own country, we won't let Jews live here? In Jordan, it is illegal to sell land to a Jew. And that is on the books of Jordan, and that is an anti-Semitic law, and you see all these heads of democratic states that, you know, brushing shoulders with the king of Jordan and embracing each other as, you know, comrades, etc. And no one goes to King Hussein and says, how can you have a blatantly racist, anti-Semitic law on your books? They get away with it. But the other question is coming from our perspective, and this is something that many people have talked about recently here in Israel. It's a new topic of conversation. Okay, What if they were to set up a Palestinian state? Like you said, what is it that means that we would have to leave our homes? Why? It's not right. It's not fair that we have to leave our homes. We should be able to live here. But by the same token, the same people will say, and we all say the same thing, what chance does a Jew have to survive in a Palestinian state? When the Arabs became citizens of Israel, no one doubted that they would be able to live and get work and study and have full rights as citizens. Everyone in the world over, in Israel and abroad, takes for granted the fact that if Jews were to be left in a Palestinian state, they would be massacred. And no one says anything about it. Nobody questions that assumption. There's something wrong with this picture.
What's wrong with the morality? Nobody is saying anything about the missiles which are shooting every day, not in the south of Israel, but almost till the middle of Israel. Nobody is saying anything about years of being under this continued threats. And nobody says anything about being okay to massacre Jews. What's wrong with the morality? I really don't understand it.
I think it's anti-Semitism. No one has ever been able to explain why is it that the Jews have been universally hated through the centuries in most countries of the world. I think it's the same thing. I don't have an answer to anti-Semitism either, but I think it's the same thing.
Sandra Osterbaras, we're really enjoying speaking to you, and we're really grateful for the time you've given us. We have probably about 5 more minutes, and I'm going to say something that maybe to some people might sound a little off, but you know, we're speaking about anti-Semitism and the Jewish homeland, the Jewish heartland of Judea and Samaria, the connections between the neighboring countries. It has been brought to my attention that perhaps the Jews are God's chosen people. And what does that mean, to be the chosen people? Some people might say that, you know, ultimately, it's that we are chosen to really be the watchers of the moral compass by perhaps our behavior. We are setting some kind of standard for morals. I don't know. What would you... I'm not sure if you want to go there, but...
No, I think, first of all, you know, whatever I think about the chosen people, I am reminded of that wonderful line in Fiddler on the Roof when Tevye says, you know, God, can't you choose someone else next time?
Right.
So I laugh at this chosen people because, unfortunately, we have been chosen for all kinds of unpleasant experiences as well. I think God did choose us for a purpose. I don't think he chose us to get the extra, you know, whipped cream on the ice cream. We have a purpose, and I think our purpose is to follow God's word and to help convey a godly message to the world. And that godly message is about Israel, but not only about Israel. It's also about a moral standard. It's about the way people should behave. It's also about faith in God. And this is something that we are supposed to be doing. Now, there's no question. There are many Jews that don't live up to that standard. And you know, people, we're like every other people. There are people who, you know, do the right thing and people who do the wrong thing. But we do have a unique mission, I think, in this world. And you know, if you think about it, nations have their own countries and nobody questions it. And yet, the fact that the Jewish people should have their own country, their own land, people question it. We're the only country in history that was exiled from its land for 2,000 years, maintained a national identity, stayed together, maintained our own language, and then came back to that land. It is absolutely unprecedented. So right there and then, you're talking about something of supernatural proportions. Maybe that is also part of this chosenness, chosenness to be significant throughout history, which I don't think any other nation has ever had. So unfortunately, it may also be that it... causes us to be the focus of negative attention. That definitely could be it. I don't think it's something that we seek, but it could be the result. And there are some people who say that a struggle against or hatred against the Jewish people is actually aimed at God. That could also be. I don't know. I don't have any answers. But I think it just looking at the situation of the Jewish people throughout history is something that it really is unprecedented and something, as a Jew, we need to come to terms with and actually welcome, together with the challenges that it offers to us. It is amazing opportunities that we need to welcome and deal with.
We certainly have a heavy burden on our shoulders.
Yes.
When we look at it from many directions, from many angles. Sandra Osterbaras, I can't say your name in one fluent way. Sandra Osterbaras. We're really at the end, and we're going to encourage people to please attend your lecture Sunday, May 15th in Fitchburg. You said at the Faith Christian Church?
That's right.
And to find out about that, where will you have a list of the other places you'll be speaking?
Well, it's all on our website, which is cfoic.com. There on the homepage at the bottom, there's a calendar of events, and if you click on that, you have all the details.
Okay, and again, I'm going to repeat that for our listeners. That's www.cfoic.com, and you had mentioned an 800 number, which I'll repeat here. You had mentioned that last week, 800-647-3344. If anybody wants to find out and attend lectures, you said, in Arkansas, Texas, Ohio, Colorado, and here in Fitchburg, it's wonderful. And again, the CFOIC stands for Christian Friends of Israeli Communities, and so you've got a large support from the Christian population, which is wonderful. Sandra Osterbaras, I said it.
You did.
We're really grateful for your time, for
you
speaking with us, and we do hope that we're able to contribute to what you're doing, to the peace in Judea, Samaria, and even in Gaza when that will happen.
Okay.
And just all over the world. And any last words before we have to close?
Well, just thank you for having me, and I do want to, you know, turn to your listening audience and encourage everyone to get involved in what we're doing. We welcome all help, Christian and Jew. Come visit us and stand with us as we hold on to biblical Israel.
Wonderful. By the way, I didn't mention that you have branches of CFOIC in Germany, Holland, South Africa, Bulgaria, America, and I'm sure that you have a future in many other countries.
Well, we have growing people coming from all over the world visiting with us in Israel and going back to their home countries and spreading the word, and that's really the model that we're trying to encourage.
And I would imagine that coming to you on a visit is a wonderful experience, so I would encourage listeners to get in touch with you also for that.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely.
All right. So
thank you.
Thank you, and
Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you.
Parashat Bechar. We read about the holiness of Shabbat and this week's Torah portion, Bechar. As the Torah tells us, and my Shabbats you shall keep. As we have mentioned before, Shabbat is one of the most important mitzvot in the entire Torah, and also the most important holiday. The Kabbalistic Zohar explains that Shabbat gives a Jew spiritual strength to carry him through the coming week. If, however, a Jew spends his Shabbat doing weekly activities, then he will not receive the special spiritual boost at the holy day of Shabbat. One who keeps Shabbat has a true sense of time, because every week he must stop and reflect when where his life is going. One who does not keep Shabbat, however, can lose his sense of time, because all the days of the week blend into each other. It is most revolutionary law that one can think about, to take a break, to reflect, to gain energy for a new weekend. Just think that this happened 3,000 years ago.
We're Rachel
and Sonia.
And this is Israel is Real. Our theme song, Hine Matov, is by myself, Rachel. You can find it at rahelmusic.net. We're on the air every Friday, 10 to 11 in the morning.
on Radio WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk, and on the internet at WSMNradio.com. We thank our guest, Sandra Osterbaras, who you can hear this Sunday, May 15th at 6:30 p.m. at the Faith Christian Church. If you want more information, that's in Fitchburg, Mass. Call 978-342-8522 or write to jewishheart@cfaith.com. You're listening to the music also of Rebbe Soul, R-E-B-B-E-S-O-U-L. We wish you a Shabbat Shalom from Israel is Real.
Shabbat Shalom.